the hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What if it was your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Should you ever set foot outside of the motel, you will be shot.
Don't miss the new Showtime limited series based on the international bestseller.
For the last 4 years, I've been a prisoner.
Why are they keeping you here?
Starring Emmy Award winner Ewan McGregor.
This is the brave new world that you dreamt of.
Be very careful. You are still a prisoner here.
Everything in this new world comes at cost.
This is still my country.
A Gentleman in Moscow. Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Only with the Paramount Plus with Showtime plan.
What's up? This is the Barton and Bud Show. I'm Barton Simmons. That's Bud Elliott. It's Thanksgiving week. We got games popping all weekend long. Bud, this is the first year because I've got, you know, I guess high-risk parents and in-laws. We're going to be doing solo Thanksgiving. I'm in charge of the turkey. I got no idea what I'm doing. The only thing I've ever done is green beans on Thanksgiving. So we're going to get this pod in a day early, so I got time to work on this turkey, man. How are things going? How's your menu looking for Thursday?
We're looking pretty good. I'm not a real big turkey guy. I know we had this on our editorial
turkey
call.
Hater.
My thoughts, and look, I don't hate turkey. It's just, I'm a grown-ass man. I mean, look at me. Like, I'm 220. I eat what I want to eat. And if I wanted turkey more often, you know what I would do? I would go eat a turkey. And yet, like, we eat it one time a year. And I people are like, oh, I love turkey. I'm like, well, I mean, it's not that hard to make. It's not easy, but it's not impossible. We should have it more often if it's actually that good. But I understand it. It's not bad.
We've got people that listen to both Barton and Bud and the Late Kick. And so sometimes we're fighting for listeners. You know, and so when you said that on the editorial call, Pate, the host of Late Kick, sort of like chimes in with this full-throated, enthusiastic endorsement of turkey by saying that he regularly drinks liquefied turkey with whey protein. Now, if you're a Late Kick regular listener and you are going to follow a psychopath like that and not come to some sound, reasonable discussion like this, I don't know what to do with you. You got to at least get both in, because that is just insanity. It's unstable. It makes me wonder about his football takes, frankly.
We peppered him with questions, and yet I still have so many more questions. Like, why would you not just add more whey protein? Like, if you want more protein in your smoothie and you're already putting some whey protein in, you know, the my thought is just go with more whey protein. Like, is it a texture thing? Are we trying to get this thicker? Is it a cost thing? Do we need to talk to CBS about getting some more money into Pate's pockets here? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, I can't even like fathom all the different reasons that would possibly lead him towards liquefied turkey. But here we are. Maybe it was some dark days back in Southern Georgia, but now, you know, hey, we're out in the open with it now. So get on Pate about his liquefied turkey. But we do have some football to talk about. Where are we starting here? But we're going to go mailbag first. We're going to do game breakdowns. Where do you want to kick things off?
We'll probably go game breakdowns. I do want to remind folks that we are not going to do playoff reactions this week on Barton and Bud. We're trying to get this out to you so that if you're driving to Thanksgiving somewhere, you can have it to listen to, or maybe, you know, day after Thanksgiving, it'll still be pretty relevant. But Cover 3 podcast, as well as the College Football Daily with Trey Scott, will have your college football playoff rankings, release, reactions. I figured we didn't need to have three podcasts in the CBS 24/7 family. I'll tackle that on the same day this week. So, you know, Thursday is more of an NFL day for the most part, but Friday, Saturday, this is a pretty solid weekend slate. It's a little top heavy, but I'm into it. I like noon Friday. You wake up, you fix your plate of Thanksgiving leftovers. Barton's going to nail the green beans. I'm definitely going to grab some of the dirty rice that my mother-in-law makes, that Louisiana recipe. And Iowa State, Texas. Mm-hmm. That's that's a nooner, but it's not a sleepy nooner. This is really for the chance to go to the Big 12 title game.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Texas's chance to kind of redeem themselves, right? They've got two losses. They are technically still in the college, the Big 12 championship race. Tom Herman is still, I think, hovering around the hot seat, but you know, he's also one of those coaches in one of those years where hot seat can turn into extension if he wins a Big 12 championship. It's kind of one of those deals. And yet I don't think I've really believed in Texas all year long. The couple of their wins have been just by the skin of their teeth without actually putting together a quality product on the field. I think as you arrive at this game, this is an opportunity for Texas to sort of win me back over. Maybe the rest of the conference, maybe the athletic director, but they can win me back over because I do think Iowa State's playing really good football right now. Last week against Kansas State, Kansas State's a flawed team. Kansas State is offensively, Will Howard is limited at quarterback, the freshman. They're really just sort of relying on Deuce Vaughn to give them some big plays. They don't have a true sort of drive the field offense to work with, but the defense has been solid throughout the season and they play good three phase football. And Iowa State just blew the doors off them. I mean, they scored, I think, every possession but one in the first half. I think they scored 7 of 8 first half possessions. Not 7, 5 of 6 first half possessions, I think, to go up 35-0. Kansas State had like 167 total yards of offense. Brock Purdy, who had some issues early in the season, is starting to sort of find himself of late. And Breece Hall is if you haven't watched Breece Hall, he's one of the best running backs in college football. So this is a really interesting opportunity I believe in Iowa State. I think that this is Texas's opportunity to show that, you know what, we actually, if we get into this Big 12 championship game, we didn't back in. Like, we really earned it. We won this. We belong. So it's an opportunity to change some narratives, I think, in Austin.
I think you're right. I mean, look, Texas has been playing better. I know Chris Hummer had a feature this week on, you know, what's going on with Sam Ehlinger. So I'd encourage y'all to go out and read that. And I know Texas is favored in this game by a point and a half. And I think Texas, they might be the better team overall, but I think stylistically there are some things you really have to like about what Iowa State does that matches up well against the Texas weakness. For one, Texas this year, they have not done a good job playing zone coverage, and they get eaten alive on these short and intermediate routes. They're freely available. If you can have a competent quarterback, you can beat them. Now, they've played some teams that don't have competent quarterback play. West Virginia, you know, being one of them. Kansas State being one of them. You know, like there's some teams in the Big 12 this year that really can't throw it around like you would expect that they could by normal Big 12 standards. But other teams can, and they've found success against this Texas defense. Iowa State's issue is not the short pass. It's the explosive pass. They've been unable to really hit too many explosive pass plays. But the short and intermediate stuff, Purdy's been nails on that. And if that's Texas's weakness, Iowa State's like, oh, man, if you insist, we'll take all these short and intermediate routes over and over again. I agree with you, by the way, on Kansas State. I think you have to separate two things. Number one, Iowa State played very well, and they clearly are an improved team over where they were earlier in the year. Number two, the jig is up on Kansas State. And I think it's to Kansas State's credit that they limped this thing along for 5 weeks with Will Howard because he can't play. And this offense under him can't play. And I mean, somebody was bound to smack them eventually. I played that at 9.5 and 10. And I think you took it at 11 or Fernelli. One of the guys on cover three did. I mean, that was one that I thought was kind of easy to see coming in a year that I've had a, you know, pretty bad gambling run of it. On the flip side, man, Iowa State's defense, it's like a little bit better in every category than what Texas does, except it's a lot better at run defense than Texas is running the football. And Texas is a good running team relative to its pass game. Iowa State's run defense is one of the best run defenses in the entire nation. Like, Ellinger's going to have to throw the ball around to win this game, I think, unless something really weird happens.
Yeah, and if they get to the point where they can really shut down that run game offensively for Texas, that's one area where I've been really disappointed in Texas this year is their wide receivers, is their ability to get open, to create big plays, to make the tough catch. Ellinger's numbers have been a little bit down, and I haven't had a chance to read Chris Hummer's piece. I'm anxious to, because he always puts out good stuff. But his numbers have been a little bit down this year, and by my naked eye, I don't know that I'm putting it all on him. Like by my naked eye, like I'm seeing him needing to get more help from the wide receiver position, and it's just not coming. And so there's some guys to me that are underachieving a little bit there. And so if the game's put on Ellinger to go try to find his receivers to make plays, I trust Iowa State a little more. And I just, again, going back to just the initial point here of this is Texas's opportunity to sort of make a bit of a statement. Iowa State has been more like it's more of a every phase of the game offense, run offense, pass offense, rush defense, pass defense. It's just a more complete team to this point. And it's not always sexy the way they do it, but it's been a more complete team. It's been a more trustworthy team. And I'm anxious to see that narrative and whether that's debunked or confirmed.
I am as well. I'm also interested in just sort of kind of bigger picture stuff. And this isn't on the outline, and Barton and I didn't talk about this, but I'm going to throw it out there. You know, some of these Urban guys, Urban Meyer was very much a QB run game based coaching tree. Tom Herman came of that. He still runs the heck out of his quarterback. To be quite honest, Dan Mullen came from that and now doesn't run the heck out of his quarterback, probably in part due to who he has at QB and Kyle Trask.
Strictly because of who he has, which is I think one of the best testaments to Dan Mullen's coaching acumen, because he's always wanted to be a run quarterback guy. He took over and Felipe Franks was a run quarterback guy. I mean, Felipe Franks didn't run under McElwain. He started running under Mullen, found himself, and then Mullen transitioned and shifted and became a different coach with a different offense because of the different skill set under center. So I hijacked you there a little bit, but I think that's kind of right, where though. You're going.
Well, you look at the guys who's recruited, you know, beyond Trask, maybe he wants to return a little bit to some more QB run game element stuff. Yeah. But I think Urban Meyer saw the shift coming in college football to the need to throw the ball better and more efficiently. Like Nick Saban has going from Hurts to Tua, getting Ryan Day, a guy who's not a big QB run guy, and not that they never run Justin Fields. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. And we say, I don't know if I want Fields taking that many hits in that opening game against Nebraska. But I think with the way that the game is called now and the, honestly, the competence that these quarterbacks have out of high school throwing the ball and your ability to get guys 5 and 6 and 7 yards downfield on the RPO stuff. I mean, you played safety. It's impossible to make a read on that if they're not going to enforce this 3-yard rule. I think the importance of taking advantage of the college rules via the passing game has never been more important. And I don't know that we've seen the passing game progression and evolution at Texas that we've seen elsewhere. And I think that is holding the back some.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because Sam Ellinger really fits that run game quarterback build and mold. But, I think that it felt like they're recruiting the right guys at the receiver positions to open things up. And and let's not act like they haven't had a lot of success throwing the ball. Even last year, I mean, they could get downfield in a hurry and they could make big plays in the long throw game. But this year, it feels like it's just been a step back. And, Tom Herman is it's on him, I guess, to get that fixed.
And yet, if they win this game, they could still win the Big 12. If they lose it, they're basically out. That's tough.
So you got anything else on that one? Or you want to go on to the next big one on Friday?
I think we covered it pretty well. Texas might be the better team. I like the matchups for Iowa State as far as.
Okay. All right. I was going to say, I thought you were about to lead me towards you think of Texas was the play here.
No. I actually think I like Iowa State and I like the under. I was actually busy on Monday when some of the unders came out, unfortunately. It opened 61. Now it's 57. So we've lost 4 points of value there against the open. But I still, 57, these offenses are not explosive in any way. And these defenses are not bad defenses.
Yeah.
They're not great, but they're not, you know, bad by any stretch. I could see these defenses still allowing a lot of underneath stuff, a lot of running the football, a lot of clock running. You could see like a 24-20 type thing.
Yeah. If this over, to me, if the over hits, it would be some sort of a Texas collapse. Like, if this is a close game, it's hard for me to envision a shootout kind of game.
I think that's fair.
Notre Dame at North Carolina. I think that this is scary for Notre Dame. I really do. I think one of the things that's impressed me about Notre Dame is defensively, they can make you play left-handed. They figure out what you do really well, and they take it away. And if taking it away means making, you know, a 2019 USC team drive the field instead of hit big plays, hey, they'll gladly give up a bunch of those yards to get them out of their rhythm and just, you know, keep the points off the board. Like, it's a defense that is, I think, malleable to the matchup. And that's one of the things that makes North Carolina so tricky. They've got a quarterback in Sam Howell that's mobile. They've got a bunch of really good wide receivers. They can obviously throw it around the yard. They've got one of the best running back duos in college football. They can run the rock as well. I'm always interested in just sort of like what the game plan is for Notre Dame defensively. I'll be really interested to see how they decide to attack a North Carolina offense that can put points on the board, because Notre Dame doesn't want to get in a shootout with a team like North Carolina. They would rather control this game and slow it down and play their style. And if it turns into a shootout, then that favors the Tar Heels here. So as everyone starts penciling the ACC championship game into Clemson, Notre Dame, and can Notre Dame get in with one loss, and can Clemson, can Clemson beat Notre Dame the second time around, and how does Trevor Lawrence's return impact that matchup? All that stuff is fine, but man, Notre Dame's got to get past this one.
They do. I think you nailed it, by the way. It's a styles make fights type of thing, and they do not want to play this ball game in a shootout. If you look across their stats and their performances this year, the only thing that really stands out that is negative about Notre Dame is they give up the bomb probably a little too frequently. And I looked into this deeper, and Bart and I, we might have a reason for concern here, just a little bit. So let's look. Notre Dame is 83rd in explosiveness allowed this year, 80th in passing explosiveness allowed. But I took a look at the passing offenses that they played. All right, Duke in the first game with Chase Bryce, not really much of a threat. USF had a million guys out for that game. They beat them 52-0. Florida State was basically running the option with Jordan Travis. Louisville, that was the day that had like the 30-mile-an-hour winds. Remember, and guys were just missing throws by they weren't even close on either side, and Kelly basically just said, we're shutting this stuff down and just running the ball and going home. Pitt was, it was without Kenny Pickett, right, I believe?
Yes.
Okay. So they're really yet to have faced a decent passing offense to this point. Georgia Tech, again, not a good passing offense by any stretch. And then they get to the last two games, and Clemson, even though it's a backup quarterback, you know, backup QB, I mean, DJ is probably the best backup quarterback in the country, unless you want to go to Tuscaloosa. And he threw the ball extremely effectively on the Irish. I think part of that was how Notre Dame decided to play Clemson. They just did not allow Etienne to get going at all. And they said, DJ, beat us if you can. And he damn near did. And then Boston College, they gave up a couple big shots to BC, but maybe there's more here to be concerned about than we realize, because of the fact that they only played two passing offenses that I would describe as even decent at this point. I mean, much less good. And North Carolina is probably the best passing offense they will have seen when you factor in the Trevor didn't play for Clemson. I think the way you got to play this, if you're the Irish, is a little more conservative on defense. Take away the run of like the run element of the RPO stuff. Sam Howell is one of the best RPO operating quarterbacks in the country. If I want to see play action against them, I want to see him just going straight drop back. And can you beat me just going straight drop back, being accurate underneath, make these receivers work underneath, and be patient, slow this thing down? Because on the other side, man, UNC's run defense is not a great matchup for the Tar Heels against this offensive line of the Irish in this run game.
So if Notre Dame can sort of play to their pace, to their with the upper hand throughout the game, then I think they're fine. But you know, kind of, you said, like, even I remember, like, the Boston College game was a game where that was sort of a trendy upset pick for Notre Dame, or at least a, you know, trendy cover pick. And I mean, Notre Dame can't run the ball. I mean, Boston College can't run the ball. And so it's going to be real easy for Notre Dame to, you know, help out their corners against Zay Flowers and those guys. It's going to be really easy for them to go too high looks and favorable matchups on the back end. It's a lot tougher task against North Carolina when they've got like four or five wide receivers that can threaten you. And they've got a running back, whoever it is back there, that's a kind of a nightmare. And so, you can't just sell out to one or the other. So if Notre Dame can sort of play with the lead and dictate the way things go in this game, then I think they're good enough offensively. And as you mentioned, North Carolina struggles enough defensively to where I don't know that oxygen that offense is ever going to get enough oxygen for North Carolina. But I don't know that very early goings in that game, I think, could be really important as to how the outcome plays out.
Yeah. If the Irish get up big, that's the time to just hit the live bet under, and let's get out of there. If Notre Dame gets up big, if UNC gets up big, that's going to be interesting, because then Ian Book's going to have to throw probably more than Brian Kelly and Tommy Rees actually want him to throw. And he may have to throw early in this ballgame anyway, because my guess is that North Carolina is going to come out and just absolutely gang up against the run and see, see if the Irish can actually throw on them and maybe get them into that mode. I saw you had a note, Barton, by the way, on Twitter about Notre Dame taking receivers and moving them to corner.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, this is what you should do, in my opinion, if you're recruiting the cornerback position. It doesn't mean like just straight up taking a guy that's never played corner and moving him to the cornerback spot. But I think one of the most critical traits at cornerback right now is the ability to play the football in the air, the ability to intercept the ball, show the body control, ball awareness to locate it and make a play on it. I mean, just look at Michigan right now, right? They're getting absolutely torched on the perimeter because Don Brown has this very aggressive defense that's going to put your corners on an island a little bit. And if you watch the way Michigan plays, it's not like the cornerbacks are just getting like burnt. It's not like they don't really have the athleticism to compete. It's just, they're not able to make play on the ball. And that's the case everywhere. I mean, there's points being scored everywhere. Everyone's offense is sort of the name of the game right now. And so really good offense is going to be really good defense. So how do you combat that? Well, you have guys that when the ball is in the air can go up and get it and are comfortable tracking the football, are comfortable attacking it in the air. And so one of the things Notre Dame, I think, of late has done a really good job of is identifying either two-way players or guys just with really good ball skills and pushing them towards cornerback. Now, this is sort of this started basically, I guess, in 2020 that I've noticed, maybe before that. But I just, they got a true freshman playing right now a pretty good bit, Clarence Lewis, who played a lot of wide receiver out of New Jersey. There's a kid named Ramon Henderson out of California that's a two-way guy that I think they're like a DB. I don't even know if he's played much this year, but he was that sort of profile. Jordan Addison, who is one of the best true freshman wide receivers in the country right now at Pitt, was a guy Notre Dame was really recruiting at one point at the cornerback position heading into senior season. I think like grades just didn't quite make the cut. So they couldn't really press there, but he would have been a monster at the cornerback spot. And then this year they just took a guy named JoJo Johnson out of Indiana that has like 800 yards receiving this year at wide receiver and also plays corner. And again, I just think that's real easy to go and pick out the guy in 7-on-7 that's been backpedaling his whole life and who runs a 4-5 or whatever and just being like, yeah, he's a stud. Well, in today's game, if that guy isn't making a play on the football, if that guy doesn't have natural ball skills, I don't know that that's true. And the best way to to sort of feel comfortable in a player's ability to play the football is him handling it in high school on offense. And so I think what Notre Dame is doing there is going to help them in the long run in the defensive backfield, because that's been a little bit of a bugaboo for them the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, is just that cornerback position. And I mean, they've had a guy or two. Julian Love, I guess, is the main one that sticks out, but they really haven't had a lot of those lockdown guys that we've seen some of these playoff contenders have. And I think they're moving in the right direction towards finding some because of the way they're recruiting and evaluating.
That's really fascinating. By the way, Barton, somebody else who agrees with you as far as cornerbacks maybe being receivers in high school, guy named Nick Saban. Quote, "None of these skill guys grew up playing defense from junior high, high school, or whatever," Saban said. "So all the best athletes end up playing offense. One of the best corners on our team is Devontae Smith. This year in camp, I trained him at corner. He can cover anybody, and he never played defense in his life because he was on the offensive side." You don't think Jalen Waddle would be a good defensive back? Saban asked.
So that was a recent quote. That's interesting.
That's a recent quote. That is from the article in which he also went off and said that good defense does not beat good offense anymore because of all the RPO stuff, and just almost the follow-up to his "is this what we want football to be" question that he asked like 3 or 4 years ago. And then he's like, "All right, I'll beat your ass that way too. That's fine."
Yeah. Well, there's a kid, one of the best players in the class of 2022 is a kid named Travis Hunter. And cool. He is he's out of Georgia. And we've long thought that he was a corner. I think Steve Wilfong actually made this comparison, and because he's balling out at receiver this year. But he might just be Devontae Smith. And I think the reason we liked him at cornerback is he intercepted the ball. And you can evaluate players. Like, it's one thing to just throw the ball to them in camp and see if they fight it. It's another thing to actually have an interception tally in high school. That tells you who's actually making a play on the football in a dynamic setting, not just, hey, can they see it well? Do they fight it? Do they have natural hands? Like, hands and ball skills, different thing. If you're actually tallying up interceptions, that tells me something about what you are as a player.
There's no doubt that we're learning more about the high school scouting process by finding out like which stats are sticky and which ones don't mean a whole lot when you go to college. Another guy, Travis Hunter is committed to Florida State. Another guy from Florida State who was a receiver in high school, turned out to have a pretty good career in college in the NFL, Xavier Rhodes. He was a receiver at Norland, and then they came in and they're like, "Yeah, you're a DB," and took a little bit, and then all of a sudden, yeah, he's a DB. All right, after this ad break, we're going to come back. We're going to break down Saturday, and then we're going to get into a couple mailbag questions, have some fun with that, and wish you guys a happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
All right, we're back. Barton, CBS 3:30. You have the Iron Bowl. Fingers crossed that we don't have yet another CBS game canceled. Hopefully this thing is able to hold up and be played. But this is awesome. Both teams are ranked. I know it's a 24-point spread. Are you giving any hope to Auburn here? Is there a path to victory for Auburn?
I can't figure it out. I don't see it. I think this is the best team in college football right now in Alabama, and this is not really that good of an Auburn team. It's not even an Auburn team that's, you know, yeah, they've survived a couple games in kind of Auburn fashion, but I feel like that was more given to them rather than them taking it. That this is a, I just don't know what, I don't know where the points come from, and I don't really know how they're going to stop Alabama. I think Alabama is starting to hit a stride. They've been, I know that it's been Kentucky and what, Mississippi State the last 2 weeks, but Alabama's been under 4 yards per play each of the last 2 weeks. Their defense continues to be questioned as compared to the sort of Alabama teams of old. But right now, among the elite teams in college football, no one's playing better defense than Alabama. And I don't have confidence in Bo Nix and Auburn to be able to generate a whole lot. And I don't have confidence in anybody, no matter how good you are, in just like shutting down Alabama offensively. I know they're a little, I guess they're a little banged up. Slade Bolden maybe got a little nicked. You know, obviously Jaden Waddle's been out, but I don't know. As long as that offensive line's there, as long as Najee Harris is there, as long as Devontae Smith's there, this team is just, I think it is separating from the pack right now.
I agree. I mean, I have a lot of Auburn friends, obviously, and I actually talked to one today and was picking his brain, and ultimately I don't see it here. Like you said, Bama's defense is getting better week by week, it seems. Tennessee had a pretty good amount of success running the football against Auburn because their linebackers had some issues in that game. Bama's offensive line and run game is a hell of a lot better than Tennessee's is, and you have to play Bama's run game differently than you do Tennessee's, because Tennessee doesn't actually know that the passing game exists, and Bama very much can hit you with it if you load up a little bit too much against the run there. On the other side of the ball, man, Auburn, I think, deserves a lot of credit for how much they've improved since the South Carolina game, you know, committing to the run, being a little more efficient in how they're doing things. I think they've made some real strides under the Malzahn-Chad Morris combo, where early in the year it was kind of a mess. But both their tackles are banged up, and Tank Bigsby's banged up.
Yeah, that hurts a little bit.
Yeah, and their center from Akron is out, and he was probably their best offensive lineman until he got hurt. I think this is a game where Bo Nix is probably running around for his life. I actually did bet this one. I played a team total. Auburn under 7.5 first half points. So my guess is Auburn will try to run the ball, keep this game a little bit lower scoring, not want to get into a pace-filled shootout, and maybe not have to throw the ball around too much until later. So I think under there in the first half makes some sense. But I don't see how Auburn moves the ball here very well. Although Gus, more than anybody except for Hugh Freeze, kind of has Nick's number.
This is always a game where I'm just tempted to, maybe not pick Auburn to win, but at least from a betting perspective, pick them to cover, to pick them to keep it close, because they just find a way to make it crazy. I really don't have that inclination this year. I don't have that temptation. I can't figure out how it's going to be close, because Alabama is, I think they have really turned the corners from a defense's perspective, and I don't like the diversity of Auburn's offense to give them fit. So I don't think this is going to be close. I kind of feel fairly confident in saying that.
Yeah, and I'm not really in a rush to bet Alabama minus 24.5. Auburn is not Kentucky. You know what I mean? Like last weekend, Bama beat them, 63-3. But I agree. 24 is not necessarily something that I want to take with Auburn either. It feels like those injuries on the Auburn side are kind of appropriately priced into 24.5. It's accounting for that, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Bama is value here. It's possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be scared to play Auburn. I would feel more comfortable playing Bama. I'm not saying I'm going to play either one, but I think I would sleep easier on Friday night, knowing I had that money on Bama.
That's fair. I guess I really can't contend that I'm going to bet Auburn under the team total for the first half and then tell you that I'd rather take Auburn. So Penn State, Michigan is a little bit of a misery bowl, an anxiety bowl, whatever you want to call this. It's yuck.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting to me on the Michigan front, I mean, they are, Joe Milton was, I don't know, potentially a wrong decision at the quarterback position. Cade McNamara has come in two games of relief work. He's accounted for like six scoring opportunities. He's thrown for, he's thrown for 300 and something yards and counted for five touchdowns and no interceptions. And I just think, if what we saw out of him at the end of that Rutgers game is real and not just a sort of new quarterback that there was no film on and little beginner's luck there, then, hey, I think you can hope that Michigan could turn the corner. That said, I think that Penn State's a better team if they're invested, even without Micah Parsons, even without Noah Cain, even without Journey Brown. If Penn State's invested, I don't care who's at quarterback, I do think Penn State is the better team, but it's just been so hard to get Penn State invested this year. Last weekend was probably their, other than the Maryland game, which continues to just sort of astound me, was there probably their worst performance. So there's no reason to think that they've sort of turned things around. But I just wonder if that juice, that boost they got from Cade McNamara is going to give Michigan a little more life, a little more buy-in for this matchup than Penn State, who's staring 0-6 in the eyes and is probably about the most miserable building to be in college football right now.
Is there a difference in your mind between a team that has quit and a team that doesn't really give a damn?
A team that has quit versus a team that doesn't give a damn. I guess maybe a very subtle difference, but I'm curious how you would delineate between the two.
So I used the term quit with Penn State after the Maryland game and got some blowback for using it from their fans, although I thought it was accurate. But clearly, like, they didn't quit against Nebraska. They fought. I don't know. Like, do they really give a damn about the rest of the season? The Iowa game was pretty disappointing. I mean, 41-21, and it wasn't fluky. I mean, they legitimately, like...
Oh, no. Iowa's just better, yeah.
It's just, how in the world do you figure out who still wants to play in these games? I mean, 0-5 versus, 1-4 for Michigan? 2-4? What is Michigan this year? They have two wins, yeah, 2-3. It feels like 0-5 almost.
The Minnesota game feels like 3 years ago. And then one of those wins is Rutgers, who, I don't know, they lose that one. I don't know what happens to Jim Harbaugh or whoever. I mean, I feel you. I guess I don't know either. I don't know how to gauge the buy-in, how to gauge who is invested in this on either side. My hunch is that it's easier to give up if you're Penn State right now than if you're Michigan. From a just matchup perspective, I'm just sitting here thinking about, like, can Penn State, how is Michigan defending the run? Because Penn State's not really shown that they're going to be able to have a ton of success doing, unless it's like totally, I mean, Michigan State just started with sort of chucking and ducking against Michigan and just throwing up to Ricky Wyatt, their true freshman wide receiver. I mean, Jahan Dotson's been that kind of guy for Penn State. By the way, Pat Freiermuth's out as well at the tight end position.
Devin Ford is hurt too.
I didn't know Devin Ford was hurt too.
Like, I don't know how many more running backs they have.
Yeah, I mean, they just got the freshman.
I'm not
left.
Saying he won't play, but yeah.
Yeah, man. This is tough. Don't know. I'm sitting here. I mean, I've been burned by Michigan a couple times already this year. But I don't know. I don't know how you bet Penn State here.
Michigan's run defense, 38th in success rate allowed, 30th in explosiveness allowed. So pretty good relative to the rest of their stat sheet, which is like almost entirely, right. Yeah, red. Exactly. I could see a Michigan win here. Am I crazy to think this game is a blowout in either direction? I mean, I think the potential variance, like the band of possible outcomes here, it's just huge, man. Like, you could tell me Michigan wins by 20 or Penn State wins by 20. And I have a little harder time believing Penn State wins by 20 just because of what their offense is doing. But
that's what I'm saying. Like, I actually have a little bit of a hard time envisioning Penn State blowing Michigan out. And that that grants a lot of faith to a Michigan team that hadn't earned a lot of faith. Like, I don't know whether I should say that out loud, because Michigan, you know, there's not been a lot of bright spots this year for that team, but Penn State's kind of shown us who they are this year. They're just not that good. At least over the course of a season. I mean, they've gotten worse as the season progressed. Indiana, they had that game won. Ohio State, they were competitive. No showed against Maryland. They kind of no showed against Iowa, and they were probably the better team against Nebraska. This is going to be the ultimate, like, bowl season is a time when you start being armchair psychologist. Good luck being armchair psychologist with this one.
Okay. We just praised Oklahoma quite a bit last week. We said they were, you know, one of the fastest improving teams in the country. We both think they have a much better playoff shot than the less than 1% that ESPN gives them. And now they got to go to Morgantown, play a game against a team, you know, coming off a bye week in West Virginia, a West Virginia team that has a really salty defense. Not gonna lie here, like the offense for West Virginia is a bad offense. Like it's not good this year. Neil Brown doesn't have those guys offensively where they need to be quite yet. Defensively, they got all kinds of dudes on defense. The Twins are really legit. Do you give the Mountaineers any kind of hope here?
I do, because I just really like this West Virginia team. And by the way, thinking back to how long ago would it have been crazy to think that these are the top two defenses in the Big 12? And, you know, depending on if you go by yards per game, these are the top two defenses in the Big 12. I know that's not necessarily the standard anymore, at least not mine. And the way Oklahoma has been playing over the last 4 weeks, I tweeted this, wrote about their, over their last like month of the season, they're 15th in the country in yards per play defensively. So they've really turned the corner on defense. And as good as West Virginia is on defense right now, and they're awesome, I wonder if like Lincoln Riley's conservative approach to the game could keep this one pretty well within arm's reach for the full 60 minutes. It's funny. I mean, Chris Hummer's in our Slack room pointing it out every week, because he's a Big 12 guy. He's always watching Big 12 football. And as I'm like trolling around all over the country looking at games, I always can like count on Hummer to give me the update and what's going on in the Texas or Oklahoma game. And he's always talking about Lincoln Riley's conservative nature. And I just sort of wonder if, with that in mind, if West Virginia can just hang around in this one.
It's certainly possible. I mean, we really haven't seen this Oklahoma team. Like, can they handle success? This is a different group of leaders than you had last year and the year before. They're showing a whole lot of improvement. Ultimately, it may just come down to West Virginia can get a whole bunch of stops, but it's hard for me not to see Oklahoma scoring 30 in this game. I mean, can West Virginia get to the mid-20s? Oklahoma's defense is playing better. But I think the Mountaineers will get some stops. They have some legit guys over there on defense who are playing much better. This is not one of those. I can't see Auburn beating Alabama this year. I can see West Virginia beating Oklahoma if they really break their way. This is not that huge of a gap in talent, I don't think.
What's the spread here?
What is it, 14, I think? No, sorry. It is 11.
Sounds about right. I was thinking like 12. This is one of my favorite games of the weekend because of the way these two defenses are playing and just seeing what's going to happen as Oklahoma's offense, it's really been clicking over the last month, goes up against a legitimate test defensively. I think this could be a statement game. I think if Oklahoma goes out and puts a number on West Virginia, I don't know how the playoff resume talk doesn't start to grow. And maybe that's a little bit too counterculture, like not mainstream enough to talk Oklahoma playoffs yet. But I feel like it's just a matter of time. If they win this game, to me, it's just a matter of time before that starts to be a real like narrative of you know, how they can get in and how different this team is starting to look.
They're playing like a top four, top five team. Like you said, there's no doubt.
Agreed.
Mailbag time?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's go. All right. So mailbag questions, most of them come from our Apple Podcast review section. Pull out your iPhone, hit that Apple Podcast, give us those 5 stars, ask us the questions. The first one comes from Jack McConigal, and he said it's an informative show, great listen, et cetera, et cetera. Jack, really appreciate it. He wants to know, where do we get our stats, like success rate and explosive play rate and things like that? So we get them from a variety of places. Obviously, I'm friends with Bill Connolly. We get them through is it True the True Media stats portal, I think we have, through CBS, whatever it's called.
Yeah, and I think that filters a lot of the so we have a stats portal of CBS that we have access to, which filters in a bunch of the PFF numbers, Pro Football Focus numbers. So that's certainly a helpful tool as well.
That's really good. Stats of War on Twitter, Parker does a really good job with a lot of the CFB data. I'd follow him. CFB data guys are good. It's certainly much more out in the open, I think, than it used to be. Although really the best place to get it is just right here on this podcast, because we filter it for you and bring you the best kind of matchup stuff that you need. But if you want to do your own, I'd recommend the CFB data guys, or somehow get hired by CBS and get access to that.
Yeah. Just poke around Twitter and there's like this little like analytics community where they all kind of know each other and they're all retweeting each other, and just follow enough for those guys and you'll dig up a few stats along the way.
All right. So what do we have here? Oh, discuss the merits of the Virginia Tech job.
Sounds like that might come open, huh?
Apparently so. Yeah, I'm surprised by this, but the buyout, I guess. So the buyout drops to $10 million on like December 15th or December 16th. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to give him next year if you're still intending to fire him, because then you're just slowing down your process even more, because you'd have to wait for the buyout to drop to what, 7.5 next December 16th, which then puts you way behind the eight ball on another recruiting cycle. We saw that was Evan Watkins today posted, what did he write? Is this VIP? Can I share this?
Our Virginia Tech site is under the impression that there is money there for a buyout if they want to make a move. I think that's fair to say. And if you want more details,
that's a pretty important hurdle to clear. Yeah. I mean, what is that? $10 million, $12 million. So that getting confirmation on that is a fairly big deal. How good of a job is this? I think is an interesting question. Within the ACC, it's probably the fifth best job.
Okay. So who
I think,
who are you looking at above it?
All right. Clemson.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right.
Florida State, North Carolina, Miami, just due to resources and availability of players in your own backyard.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly from a prestige standpoint, I feel like that's sort of where it falls.
Do you put it ahead of Louisville?
I would
too, just because of who's in my division as well. Like you, that they are not in Clemson's side of the thing.
Also, there's a really like strong football culture in Blacksburg and around that program. I think that's something to, I think you can, and I do think also the nice thing about Virginia Tech as a job is you can kind of recruit however you want to recruit. If you want to be an evaluator, developer, as long as the results come, I think you can do that. You don't have to be pressured into bringing in top 15 classes every year. And yet I think probably if you get it rolling there, you're capable of that. I think that's a, that's a program. I don't know facility wise. I just don't know the answer. How are they from a facilities and infrastructure standpoint? Do you know the answer to that?
I haven't been up there recently. I was there in 2012. From reading their message board, it seems like that there are some upgrades they need to make to facilities. I kind of doubt they're terrible, but
right.
it seems like their message board are saying, hey, like, this is why facilities matter. And they're showing some examples of other facilities, like not the Hokies facilities, obviously. Right. So, you know, we'll see. I guess we'll see what they can do. I think it's a pretty good job, though, man. I mean, like, if they're like fifth in the ACC ish, which is kind of a fair slotting, I think. I'm sure they would tell you that it's a better job than UNC. And based on what both programs have won, I get that. But I think UNC has a higher ceiling than the Hokies do, probably long term. How many SEC jobs would you take over this?
Well, here's a question, because they might be open at the same time. What would you take, South Carolina or Virginia Tech?
Oh, Virginia Tech, no doubt.
Right.
I could raise my kids. And like, South Carolina, I know their fans hate me right now because I said this, but I'll say it again because it's still true. The chance you're fired in 4 to 5 years at South Carolina is probably like 80%. Historically, that is a one contract job. You're taking South Carolina because you believe in yourself, okay, which is great, and you think you're going to do a good job, but also your agent wants you to take it because you're going to bank $20 million guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
If you do a good job at I don't think Virginia Tech has that unreasonable of expectations. What they did in the, you know, early 2010s, like late aughts, is probably not super repeatable. I don't think they're going to win the ACC, you know, three times in 5 years or whatever. Not that, you know, Clemson's rolling now, but other than that, like, I think their expectations are fairly reasonable. And Fuentes just had a lot of missteps there, including the you know, kind of dalliance he had with Baylor last year, which turned out to be pretty public. And then he tried to play it off like nothing had happened. This is a pretty good job. Recruiting wise, though, it does come with its challenges. It's in the middle of nowhere, and there's a lot of competition for players around where the Hokies typically recruit, man.
So a couple of names that just sort of would jump to mind. I think, first of all, Billy Napier is sort of assumed that he's sort of like SEC bound at some point. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Billy Napier just sort of, you know, drives right past South Carolina and like goes, knocks on Virginia Tech's door and is like, hey, what are you guys offering? Because to me, again, like, it's a guy who's been in the ACC. It's probably a more winnable job than South Carolina. And I think he kind of understands that. So I would be curious how that looks in terms of, you know, what kind of competition emerges there, if any. Again, this is not even a job that's open yet, but it's fair to speculate here. I think Will Healy at Charlotte be an interesting name as well. Kind of a hot name that's young. Maybe you're getting him like a year before you're expecting him to really break through. But that would be sort of an upside play. You could look towards sort of a Sean Lewis type at Kent State, who is putting up huge numbers, offenses travel, and he's had a pretty remarkable turnaround at Kent State. And then I think, you know,
that's a good name.
Coordinator list too. Like, you know, Tony Elliott at Clemson, like that would be probably one that, that he'd take a look at. I don't know. That's a really, really interesting. And obviously, you know, South Carolina is circling Shane Beamer. I don't know. I guess Shane Beamer would be potentially an option, though. That feels weird for him to just follow Pops down to Virginia Tech.
When we do our coach grades of no doubt, okay, fine, or I don't get it, man, you can explain to me the Shane Beamer thing 100 times. I'm just still not sure. Like, are you really going to fire Will Muschamp so that you can be the first in line to hire Shane Beamer?
I don't get it either.
Like, what? I mean, look, coaching hires that we don't get work out all the time, and ones that we think are slam dunks fail at a much higher rate than I think anybody in college football wants to accept. There is a crapshoot element to this, but I don't totally get that. I think this is a really a pretty damn good job. You have an AD that is very well respected in the industry in Whit Babcock. And ultimately, he hired a guy in Fuente who was universally praised for the hire. Like, that was something that was seen as they did their homework. This should work out. And ultimately, it's just not working out. I don't know if that's a relationships issue, a recruiting issue. And their recruiting rankings have been kind of underwhelming, to be honest, relative to what I thought they would do under Fuente. He's not a particularly good recruiter. I think that the ceiling at Virginia Tech is certainly higher. And they say you want to be the guy who comes after the guy who replaces the guy. I just totally botched that. Like, don't be the guy who replaces the legend. Be the guy who replaces the guy who replaced the legend. I could see this working
and
out.
And Fuente wasn't a great recruiter of Memphis either. I mean, he was sort of an evaluator too. And so that he has come to Virginia Tech and not been a great recruiter at Virginia Tech, to me, indicates that you don't have to be scared away because of lack of recruiting prowess, because the guy that's there doesn't have a reputation for great recruiting prowess anyway. So if you can recruit, you know, go change the narrative on that front. It's something that is, it's one of those jobs. It'd be fun to see good again. I mean, I think Virginia Tech, you know, what the old lunch pail defense is under Bud Foster, like when they're playing well, I think that's a fun program for college football.
So the thing is, like, we've seen them recruit better too. 2017, their class ranked 26th. 2018, their class ranked 24th. Last 2 years, their class is really, I mean, it's kind of fallen off a cliff, man. 2020, they were 76th. I know it took a small class. Fair enough. They only took 16 dudes. But 2021, this year, they're only 43rd. And that's with 21 commits. I mean, just no four stars so far in their class. Just an overall kind of lack of talent being brought in. And you can tell me that they're great evaluators. Sure, maybe they are. And you can be a great evaluator and hit on a higher percentage than expected of your three stars and still have less talent than somebody who's a poor evaluator, who is a gatherer of four stars. You know what I mean? Like it's an odds game. Yeah, you can exceed the odds of your three stardom somewhat, but eventually that's going to run out. Probably when you play teams that recruit better than you. Still, it's a good job, and I don't know. I would rather take it than South Carolina, unless South Carolina wants to give me a contract that is, you know, more realistic as far as expectations go. But I don't know about that.
We'll see. Find out soon, I bet.
Apparently 8-4, 9-3 is the baseline in Columbia.
Yeah. I hope they're hiring someone.
Yeah. Which,
I don't know, man.
That's been true for like 3 out of 110 years of football.
Yep, those 11 win seasons under Spurrier. It is possible.
It's possible. As long as they can get Muschamp to go back to Florida, then it's really possible.
That's a good point.
I mean, like that's
that is a good point. I hadn't even thought about that. They're getting 11 wins because they're beating Florida.
Right. Exactly.
Muschamp.
Oh, man. All right.
All right.
Hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving, man.
Absolutely. Good luck with all your preparations. I got to go Google turkey recipes. So wish me luck.
Oh, you didn't give everybody the green bean recipe.
The green bean recipe? Am I supposed to?
Yeah, you said you usually do the green beans. Like what goes into that?
Oh, that's a family secret. That's okay. Locked up. That's a Simmons family recipe. It's gone back generations. You know, I could tell you, but not with this wide, massive audience that we've got. That thing will be all over the place. We gotta keep it close quarters.
Pandemic, we might have a run on supplies. Barton goes to the store to get his stuff, and everybody's already bought it up.
That's right.
All right, have a good one, buddy.
All right, later.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.